Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm delighted to welcome for University Matters on Campus FM today, Professor Stella Borge-Barthe. This is the second in our mini-series, which is focusing on the Department of English here at the University. So I'll just say a few words about my guest. Professor Borge-Barthe was awarded her PhD by the University of Malta for her thesis on myth and history in the West African novel. That was in 1997. She's obviously works within the Department of English, and there she teaches courses in post-colonial literature and theory and in 18th and 19th century English and American fiction. She mediates the department's membership in international associations and is the academic coordinator for Erasmus students. Professor Borge-Barthe convened the conference of the European Association for Commonwealth Literature and Language Studies, also known as ECLALS, in March 2005, and was appointed adjudicator for the Commonwealth Writers Prize later the same year. She edited the proceedings of the conference. She's the author of papers and book chapters, mostly on Australian and African fiction. Her current research interests include post-colonial and Anglo-Arab writing. Professor Borge-Barthe set up the local branch of the European Society for the Study of English in 2006, and she was elected secretary for ECLALS in August 2011. Welcome to the program, Professor Borge-Barthe. So today we're going to be talking about a course that has been held within your department and a concept which you are going to continue within the department, and that is the concept of writing the Mediterranean. I can see that Malta, or the University of Malta, is a perfectly based place for this kind of study. It's in the very heart of the Mediterranean Sea, in the middle of the earth, as it used to be, and certainly a hub of human history. So, yes, I would imagine that writing the Mediterranean is a concept that suits the University of Malta well.
And it suits the Department of English in a particular way, because what we have as a Department of English and as the Maltese, as you know, English speakers in Malta, is a convergence of English knowledge, English culture, together with our very central place in the Mediterranean. So I feel that from this perspective, that special focus of English literature, highlighting, however, the Mediterranean aspect of such literature in English, really needs to be carried on from our department. And it is for this reason that we started holding this course 3 years ago. Now it's the result of some years of study and discussion, even with several universities abroad, who have in the past been able to co-teach the course with us. It is a postgraduate course, and it is a course that we continue to develop.
What does it discuss, really? The list of possible connections between English literature and the Mediterranean are endless, really.
They are, in fact. Our students already have a basis in English literary studies. And then we look at literature across the ages and the way that English literature has fed of them, developed, for example, from Greek literature, what it has taken from these Odysseys, for example, traceable then in the work of James Joyce, traceable earlier than that in Dante's Ulysses, and of course the influence that had on later British writing. So we look at writing both emerging from the Mediterranean, that is, written written from the Mediterranean, but also about the Mediterranean or set in the Mediterranean. And that, of course, allows us to put together various aspects, various periods of history that would otherwise be thought piecemeal in different courses.
And there's the idea of otherness, which I know is an important factor when you're talking about a literature which is being created in an English literature which is being created in a non-English ambiance, so to speak.
Yes, in fact, we do highlight the otherness of the Mediterranean in different ways. First of all, we have the very close relationship between England and Italy, and the depiction of Italy, for example, from the perspective of E.M. Forster, where the Italian is always the other, where the South is treated, the South would be, Italy is the South, and it is construed as another to the British character, to the English character. More recently, then, there is what one can talk of as the post-colonial Mediterranean, and this has allowed us to go into literature accessible in English, sometimes written in English, but sometimes translated into English, emerging, in fact, from places like Morocco, from Algeria. So it is, in fact, a course that puts together writings that would not otherwise be studied for the correspondence that they would have.
Going back a bit, of course, again, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of how much Shakespeare is really set in the Mediterranean, and how many of those stories have their genesis within the Mediterranean, the idea of Venice, of course, and other places. I think that's obviously Shakespeare being the great writer in the English language, and there's this Mediterranean connection, which is really so strong.
Which we do exploit, in fact. I mean, whenever we've held this course, we've always made sure to have at least one session focused entirely on Shakespeare. And we have the students learn about different representations of countries, mostly Italy, but even Cyprus, for example. And it is a way of looking not only at, it is very much Shakespeare's Mediterranean, it's also an Elizabethan view of the sea, and it also brings with it the relationship of the Elizabethans with the Mediterranean and its people, which was also already at that time another.
And the Romantics, of course. Mm-hmm. I was speaking before to Professor Vassallo, who, of course, is really the person to talk to about the Romantics and how much the Romantics actually took from Greek myth, for example.
We were very lucky from this perspective, because Professor Peter Vassallo, in fact, participated in this course along with, I think, six members of my department actually participate in this course. So you're able to make use of specialisms of that these people can bring to the course. And that is another advantage, when you are allowing each person to play his best. And so it was very useful, in fact, to have Peter Vassallo contribute to this course, and I hope, that in the future we've also had Nicholas Rowe contribute to the course. So I hope that in the future we'll have other opportunities to continue to present this course with all these highly qualified people participating and giving their best, in fact.
And of course we're not just talking about literature as in the novel. There's also other genre which can be looked at, I mean, drama, travel poetry. Writing as a genre on its own.
We make sure, in fact, that it is not too heavily based in fiction, that we include, in fact, both poetry and drama. The Romantics come in, through the poetry of Keats and of Byron, The Curse of Minerva, Shelley, Prometheus, Unbound, Keats, Ode to a Grecianer, or on first looking into Chapman's Homer. We're very, very attentive to these reconstructions of Greece, reconstructions of Italy, because these highlight not only that, perhaps they highlight England and 19th century England more than they actually highlight Greece. You know, so we are enabling our students to bring together these studies, allowing them to deepen their studies, to see, in fact, how these different perspectives, Shakespeare, and then at the same time, the Romantics, an evolution of English thoughts about the Mediterranean.
In fact, I'm always interested to see how the English have interpreted the Mediterranean, really, or especially Italy, of course, as you have mentioned, that very close connection, but also other parts of the Mediterranean, how the Northern Europeans have looked at the Mediterranean and how they've interpreted it.
It becomes a southern question, you know, and in fact that was the focus of one particular session that we held on Cagliari, because we had, at one point we also had Professor Mauro Pala from Sardinia participating on the course, and he was able to study a number of texts, you know, really important texts by Franco Cassano, for example, Gramsci even, Sardinian writers such as Marcello Foa, Sergio Azzeni. There we are seeing how Northern Europe, the whole of Northern Europe, cast the South as another. The study of Europe, the vision of Italy and the South as a South, as another to the North, right? We do not just through literature, but even through theoretical works. For example, Gramsci from Sardinia.
Prison Notebooks.
Yes, Prison Notebooks. Franco Cassano with his Southern Thoughts and other essays on the Mediterranean. Dainotto, who writes about Europe, but especially about Northern Europe's perspective of the South of Europe. In fact, throughout the course, we've given a great deal of importance to the theoretical framework so that we enable an understanding of the Mediterranean as a region. We look, of course, at Brodel's monumental work, The Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World in the Age of Philip II. The more political approach of Ian Chambers in his Mediterranean Crossings, where one of the points of focus is, in fact, the contemporary phenomenon of south to north migration.
I spoke to with Agent Rima recently, and he was talking about literature in the Mediterranean as such. And he was mentioning the Camus idea about how the northerner looks at the south and how the south is devoid of the Puritanism that really has become part of Northern Europe, and how the north looks with a certain fascination at this southern neighbor, really.
They do, and in fact, Dr. Adrian Grima participated in our course as well, you know, and he helped us bring in, of course, our own product, Maltese poetry. Adrian Grima spoke with Daniel Massa about contemporary Maltese poetry, especially Maltese poetry which is either written in English or else has been translated into English. And we had one session, in fact, where our students, that were not only Maltese students, but coming from various universities, were able to study also our own contribution to the Mediterranean.
In one of the characters of one of the books, I'm afraid I forget the name exactly now, I would like to say it wrongly, one of the characters says that they feel freedom on the sea and not mm-hmm. when she mm-hmm. reaches the land, mm-hmm. because real freedom can only be on the sea. And somehow, you know, you look at the Mediterranean and you tend to look at the countries all around it, and not think of it as the sea as being a place. And it's fascinating
to think
of it like that.
Because that is, for Adrian, you know, who wrote about Daniel Massa's poetry, he considers Daniel Massa's take on the Mediterranean to be unique in Maltese poetry, precisely because it goes outward into the sea. It's not confined to the land. So it was interesting there, you know, to be looking at the sea as a sea,
yes,
you know.
Another dimension, gives a whole another dimension.
Another dimension. It does.
You were mentioning the phenomenon of migration, which fits into this concept of writing the Mediterranean, but also goes beyond that.
I have been looking at North African writing now for a number of years, even before this contemporary phenomenon of migration, south to north migration. There was, as you know, a lot of news about the Arab Spring. And in the first time we held the course, there was a lot of focus, in fact, on the Arab Spring, particularly on writings coming from Egypt. There, in fact, you know, in the Egyptian writing, which is available to quite an extent in English, you have people like Sonala Ibrahim, Najib Mahfouz, of course, Sadawi, Karra, Leila Ahmed, Ahdaf Suwaif, who either wrote in response to the Arab Spring, or it was discovered that retroactively that what they had written anticipated. In fact, perhaps this is truest of all of Ala al-Aswani and his Yacoubian building, because that projected the Egyptian apartment block with the various families living in it, the Yacoubian building, in a post-Tahrir manner, you know. And in fact, in the first time that this program was presented, my own work and the students' work was on Egyptian writing, with particular reference to al-Aswani's Yacoubian building.
But the phenomenon of migration within the Mediterranean, of course, is definitely not only a modern phenomenon. I mean, if you look back and look at even the way the Maltese have moved around the Mediterranean, that there are Maltese in Corfu, and there are Maltese in Gibraltar, and the Maltese in Tunis, and obviously in Egypt as well. So this phenomenon of migration, which has sort of taken over our heads and minds and thoughts, of course, is nothing new.
No, it isn't. Of course, the migration that you're mentioning now tended to be a north to south. For example, Camus himself, you know, the family had migrated to Algeria, you know, for economic reasons, like many other French families. They had migrated there. Many Maltese people migrated to North African countries. And in fact, this is included in some of the novels that I am looking at present. For example, in Tahar Ben Jalloun's Leaving Tangier. There, in fact, one of the characters is reading the journal kept by his father, where he had gone to Morocco to escape political, he had become involved with communists, and he had to escape France at one point and go to Morocco. So what we're seeing now is migration that is south to north, with a number of novelists depicting migration sometimes in different ways. Of course, it is one thing when you have a Maltese businessman migrating to Alexandria, where you have a certain backing, a certain support, where you are going for better opportunities. It is, again, different when you are escaping unemployment. For example, in some of the novels, what is sought is a dignified way of life. There is the novel by Maria Giovanna Mirano, Uomini Liberi. There it is a dignified way of life. That is also the same in Leaving Tangier by Tahar Ben Jalloun. He is not escaping war. You know, he is escaping, in fact, the humiliation of having to be supported by his mother and his sister. frequently the reason for leaving Morocco is that. In other, migrants leave from African countries, it may be a question of seeking asylum. And in fact, I have been looking at a number of asylum narratives. Carol Phillips, for example, A Distant Shore, which he published in 2005, I mean, where Gabriel, or Solomon, as he is known once he is in the UK, escapes war. He flies for his life. He has to assault his uncle to take the money, you know, in order to escape with his life. He has to watch without intervening as his mother and his two sisters are killed and raped. In that order. And then he only manages to escape by attacking his uncle and taking the money that he needed to pay in order to make the crossing.
You've been studying Commonwealth literature for some years now, pre this latest phenomenon of transition from south to north. In the writers that were writing in that post-colonial period, perhaps the 60s and the 70s, do you feel that they were, some of them did anticipate what might happen, or do you think they were, I mean, I don't know, I haven't read a lot, so I'm, excuse my ignorance, but do you feel that they were optimistic about the future?
Writing about migrant life comes later than the actual act of migration. I mean, if we're looking at the first generation of writers in countries such as Kenya or Nigeria, the major concern there is national independence, and following that, then the corruption that ensued. But the focus is their own country. It takes another generation then to find that the phenomenon of travel and migration, because these writers themselves, I mean, writers like Ayikwe Arma, for example, spent many years in America. The Kenyan Ngugi Wa Thiong'o has spent most of his life in England and in America. But migrant writing appears later. I'm trying to pin it to a day. I think one of the earliest that I know about, it doesn't mean it is the first one, but something like the Buddha of Suburbia, for example, mid-80s, I think it would be. Rushdie, you know, I mean, from the mid-80s onwards, I think you tend to find that that kind of migrant writing, where the migrant experience begins to be recorded, critiqued, talked about. And it goes on. It's a very vibrant realm, you know. You've got Small Island by Levy, you know, a number, even White Teeth and so on, you know. There are a number of these. What is, I think, even newer is asylum narratives. Because one of the distinctions that I see coming in is a distinction between migrant, being a migrant, a voluntary migrant, where you have gone perhaps for better opportunities, or because it suits you better, because it suits your perspective better. There's a difference there to when people are escaping, where they are risking their lives, the way that they are, in fact, risking their lives crossing the Mediterranean. I am very much concerned with that now, because it is happening now. People like Ian Chambers, for example, connects this with colonialism, connects it with the post-colonial. He calls the Mediterranean, the second chapter of Mediterranean crossings is in fact called a post-colonial sea. Because there is an effect of colonization, but it has to be then, first of all, it spills over. It cannot only be, I think, accounted for simply by colonization. But certain forms of doing business, shall we say, right, in a globalized world, have caused, partly again, the kind of migrations that we are witnessing now. And it is my hope, you know, in looking at these stories of asylum, that I will be able to learn more about the representation. For example, you know, I'm looking at a number now, for example, Distant Shore, Woman in Liberty, Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits by Laila Lalami. You can see in those three characters that have no other way but to escape, whatever the risk.
You have no choice.
And I think people, even people in Malta, need to understand this a little bit more. We need to be a little bit more open to the fact that many of the people who are in fact taking that risk their lives, the lives of their children, because there's nothing further that they can do. And the way it is represented is important. For example, sometimes most of the onus is carried by the traffickers. For example, Woman in Liberty by this Giovanna Mirano, I think it's a 2007 novel. She depicts it as a problem that is practically resolvable by putting an end to trafficking. But of course, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? As long as there is the possibility of making it, they're going to try. And there will be
try again and again.
And try again and again. In fact, in Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits, the Laila Lalami novel, for two of the characters, it's the second attempt that is successful. Of course, many others drown, and in fact, the drowning that is Tahar Benjelloun, who depicts that, you know, the sea and Spain, the image of Spain, which for the person in Morocco spells freedom, he depicts that as, he calls it Tusia, and she is depicted like a siren, drawing men, you know, and leading them, in fact, to their deaths.
And with that thought, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it here. Thank you very, very much, Professor Stella Borbaite, for coming to talk to us today on University Matters.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.